Committee on Transportation and Economic Development. It's Thursday, February the 20th, 2003. At this time, I'm going to open a public hearing, and this will be prior to the time that we open the public hearing on for the Public Utilities Commission. At this time, with a tap of the gavel, I'll do that. And Senator Morris and Satish are going to talk about, and this applies to all the budgets we'll be looking at in the future, an idea on trying to get more clarity, understanding of the budgets. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize. I'm going to have to leave. I have an appointment at 9:30. So, but I did want to come back to a question that I asked yesterday with respect to the cost per FTE. And what I have found, as at least for me personally, as I listen and go through all these different budgets, there's one common denominator. It's reducing costs to some unit. And the cost per FTE, I think, is helpful to evaluate an agency with respect to other agencies, factoring in, of course, some agencies are highly staffed with professionals and others are not. But, you know, notwithstanding those differences, and then speaking with Satish afterwards, after yesterday's meeting, the budget data that we have here that my staff had prepared does not factor in some of the flow-through dollars, and that's unknown in some of these budgets. And the ability to then go back and pull out any flow-through dollars, just look at the total support admin costs on a unit basis for FTE, I think would help us to get some relative value as to how these agencies are operating. And so that would be my request, is that we have the ability to look at the cost per FTE on a, not a weighted basis, but on an adjusted basis for any flow-through funds that may be within those categories.
Take a shot at that, please.
Mr. we did do that. Or we can cover it later. We can give you just a big number right now. We can talk about details at a later time.
Okay. Satish, were you going to talk about the whole issue, or were you going to basically fill us in on the Public Utility Commission's numbers?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, yes, what we will do is I will be working with LFO staff, and we'll be providing you this information for any budget that will be appearing before you, before this subcommittee. And basically, it'll be the cost of FTE with comparison to the cost of administration, except the flow-through dollars. So we will work to provide that information for you.
Thank you.
Because I think also, Satish, what we're talking about, you have a piece here with Frank Rouse. Excuse me one second. And trying to get a handle on what is our actual cost. I mean, the person there and in the area within the budget that they're functioning in. I think that's critical to know, you know, how much is the staff, say, for example, central administration is versus, you know, an inspector or, you know, like, for example, I'm sure those folks that do all the analysis probably get paid pretty well. And that's appropriate because, I mean, these are very, very competent, certified smart tech people. So, but it's helpful for us to get some sort of handle on how that fits into the whole budget picture because, you know, with our budgets, it's not that critical because we have so many dedicated dollars. But we're being asked in all these, in almost every one of these budgets, to approve substantial fee increases, and we need to be able to justify that. And so that's the process. Any questions from you two? Is that something that you would see? Because we've been told that we can take this anywhere we need to go in order to get a handle on the budgets.
Happy to sit down with Satish and Chris and work out, give them the numbers, at least for the PUC.
Right. Okay, Frank, are you ready? I'll go ahead and then open up. We'll get started and we'll hear this report then. I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 5539. And Satish, it looks like you're the first person on the list to start with this.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee. This time I'm presenting to you the Governor's budget for the Public Utility Commission. And you all should have copies of my presentation document in front of you that was handed yesterday. If you'll turn to page 2. The recommended budget consists of $157.3 million of total funds. This is a 43% decrease from the 2001-2003 legislatively approved budget for the fifth special session. This includes $35.4 million of limited funds. This is the agency's operating budget, and this is an 8% increase. The budget also includes $121.9 million of non-limited other funds. This is nearly a 50% decrease, and this is due to the new estimate of the Oregon Universal Service Fund that was discussed yesterday, revenues. So the agency has projected a decrease in revenues, so the expenditures from this fund would be lower. So that's why you see a huge 50% decrease. If you turn to page 3, the budget consists of the non-limited other funds. That's the major portion of the budget. That's nearly 78%. And then there are around 22% of the budget is other funds. A majority of the other funds are from fees paid by investor-owned utilities. And there's also the Residential Service Program Fund, which is paid by monthly surcharge levied against local phone companies. So if you go to page 4, the governor's budget, as I mentioned earlier, is in total around a 43% decrease. The major changes approved by the 2002 first to the fifth special sessions. This is the one that you see in every agency's budget. This is the employee compensation adjustment. And for the PUC, it consists of $798,962 other funds and $12,061 federal funds. Now, what does the governor's budget do? It basically continues all existing programs. It accommodates increased workloads in the hearing division by replacing two limited duration positions with permanent positions. It reclassifies upward seven positions based on increased job duties. And it adds two positions to support the legislative concept dealing with the regulation of slamming, which is the unauthorized changes of telephone services, and cramming, which is the unauthorized telephone charges that you people see in their phone bills. Turning to page 5, this shows the various program units that make up the agency. The largest budget is for the utility regulation program, and it's a 84%. The reason why it is so large is because the Oregon Universal Service Fund is part of the utility program. Policy and administration consists of 10% of the budget, and the Residential Service Protection Fund consists of 6% of the budget. And if we turn to page 6, here are the expenditure categories. Special payments, this is the Oregon Universal Service Fund payments. Consists of around 77% of the budget. Personal services is 12.28% of the budget. Services and supplies around 11%. And capital outlay is very small, less than 1%. Now, how was the budget developed? The starting point was the 2001-2003 legislatively adopted budget. This consists of $275.1 million of total funds. Now, there were base budget adjustments, the largest one being the roll-up of the 2001-2003 position actions and compensation changes. This is $2.4 million of total funds. And this consists of, again, we've discussed this in the other agency hearings, the cost of living increases, which now are going to be, a portion of this is going to be removed, the increase for the public employment retirement system contribution, and health benefit costs. The second base budget adjustment consists of a reduction of $121.2 million of non-limited other funds. This is to reflect the anticipated expenditures from the Oregon Universal Service Fund during the 2003-2005 biennium as a result of reduced collections. Now, under essential packages, you will see that there's an increase of $26,484 total funds, which provides for standard inflationary increases for temporary appointments, overtime, and differential costs. And there's also an adjustment for vacancy savings. Package 030 provides the standard inflation for services and supplies, and there's adjustments for changes in state government service charges. This consists of $877,041 total funds. The agency does have a number of policy packages. Package 081, this also you see in every agency's budget. This is a reduction of the cost of living increases that was to go for employees that were at salary range 38 or higher. For the PUC, this is a reduction of $43,433 of other funds and $208 federal funds. Now, package 101, this is the policy and administration reclassification. This package reclassifies three executive specialists, one positions, to executive specialists, two positions, one program tech, two position, to a principal executive manager, C position, one purchaser, one position, to a purchaser, two position, and one support services supervisor position to an office manager position. Now, all of these reclassifications were reviewed by the Department of Administrative Services, Human Resource Services Division, and the governor's budget does not provide any extra funding for these reclassifications. The agency will need to eat this cost, and they'll be doing this through cutting their services and supplies budget by $21,468 for the 0305 biennium. So package 102, it's the residential service protection reclassification. This package reclassifies one program check two position into a principal executive manager C position. And the total cost of this position would be $5,822 other funds. Again, the governor's budget does not provide this funding. The agency will be shifting funds from services and supplies to absorb this cost. Package 103 is the hearings division increased workload package. This replaces one limited duration administrative law judge position into a permanent position. This will also be financed through savings in services and supplies. And Commissioner Bayer talked about this package yesterday. The agency really needs this position because of transition, retirements, and also workload issues. Package 104, it's a hearings division law clerk position. This replaces one limited duration law clerk. Actually, it's a half-time position with a permanent position. And this package is also going to be financed with savings and services and supplies. Package 107 supports the legislation that's out there that deals with slamming and cramming of telephone bills. This increases other funds expenditure limitation by $192,908 other funds and provides two staff positions to support the legislative concept dealing with regulation of slamming and cramming. There is one technical adjustment, and that is in package 102. We have the Orbis system. That's the technical system where we key in numbers in the budget. When we put this package in the system, we forgot to do the changes from reduce the services and supplies and increase the personal services. So that needs to be done. So it's a technical adjustment. That would need to be done if you approve package 102. So that is my presentation. So if you have any questions, we'd be glad to answer.
Okay. Thank you very much. I almost said Senator Bayer.
I'm going to leave. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, again, Lee Bayer, Commissioner of the Oregon Public Utility Commission, joined today by also Commissioner Hemingway and Rick Willis, the PUC's Executive Director. Where we're at to today is your questions. What we've gotten both in the meeting yesterday and subsequent to that by some of you was a list of 11 questions, and we're prepared to go through those, walk through, and we'll be splitting up the responses, some between the three of us, if that's okay with you, Mr. Chair. First one that Senator Dukes asked about was whether Burnside Water Association fell under our jurisdiction or not. And sort of our surprise yesterday is we didn't know.
Gee, I can't imagine.
But what we did find out, Senator, is that Burnside is an association. So technically, it does not fall under, it's not clear generally whether it falls under our jurisdiction or not. Right now, because no one has asked, they don't. We're not relating to them, and we may not in the future. Depends on the status of whether they're serving customers besides the association members or not. As you recall, one of the pieces of legislation that we have introduced at the suggestion of the Water Steering Committee was to clarify that issue. If that is adopted by the legislature, essentially what it would say is that they could, if 20% of the customers or the association itself came forward and asked us to take jurisdiction on their rate-making process, then we would. But right now, we do not.
The public are on their own. And Burnside does an excellent job. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, the folks are just out there on their own, and if the group doesn't do an excellent job, but then...
It's a more confusing issue than it sounds like on the surface.
Okay.
And essentially, the good news is that most of them seem to be working, and there's nothing there, and it's I think it's real clear if you think about it, if you have a water company that has 100 customers, you know, we all sort of understand that. But what you get into is if you had a mobile home park, for example. If the mobile home park takes water in at a single meter and just includes that in the space, rent charges, no big deal. They're not regulated. It's just part of rent. But if they chose to sub-meter that, well, then they would. Then, depending on the ownership of that, if it's owned in common, then it's questionable. Shift from that to a condominium. You could have the same kind of issue there. I think you have to back up in terms of how we get involved is really if there's a relationship where there is an entity that's selling water to individual homes that don't have a control over that pricing or don't have an involvement in board, that's when we would act on their behalf, on the customer's behalf. But you're absolutely right. There's some out there that we just don't know about unless somebody complains. And from our perspective, that's okay if no one's complaining. These are not the small ones, as I said yesterday. They're not the easiest ones to deal with. There's a vital service, lack of sophistication sometimes in dealing with it. But as long as things are going along hunky-dory, that's okay with us. Does that get at your question?
Yeah, there are four of them in the little area that I live in.
They are surprising to me. They are literally sprinkled throughout the state, but it seems like most of them are in Central Oregon, which I... they tend to be bigger, you know, just different development practices around the Bend area. The second question you ask is actually Representative Smith asked us about had to do with... flexibility in dealing with code violations, and I think we're handing something out now. We went back and checked specifically on the issue that the representative raised from his northeastern Oregon thing, and we have been doing more contact over in that area recently. The representative, as far as we can tell, represents at least four large in terms of territory co-ops, but small in terms of customers. And some of them have been getting into other areas like providing telephone services and mixing the wires on the poles and that. And so we've been working with them a little on that. To our knowledge, we don't have any complaints from the utilities, although as I was talking with our inspection staff yesterday, which were sort of surprised, because our normal process when we're doing that is they're going out, they're doing it on the field. Often, in fact, they're invited in by the staff people within the utility that's asked to, you know, to deal with the safety issues for them. And they do a cooperative effort, but as they're going through, they identify the problems. They usually send out, and in fact, if they have a problem, they actually take a picture of it as part of the process and send that out. Then the utility has the opportunity to comment on that, and they work out a plan for correcting them. And normally what we're trying to do is get an upgrade over a 10-year period. So it's not, unless there's a public safety, you know, where a life-threatening issue, it's not a absolutely fix it on the spot or fix it tomorrow. It's let's work out what's reasonable. The issue that I think is pushing a lot of the smaller utilities is also the one we were talking about yesterday, and that's rates. You know, as the power costs have been going up, in the natural tendency of those, particularly consumer-owned, is to, and I think hopefully all of them, is to keep that cost down. And where you sort of squeeze the accordion is on your own M cost. And that's part of that. And so when we're going in saying, yeah, but you got this issue that you need to take care of in some reasonable period of time, that's pushing against that. So I think that's where the tension is. What I did do yesterday is set up a meeting time next week to sit down with Representative Smith and with to bring in our supervisor of that so we can talk firsthand and get those issues specific. And I would offer the same to the rest of the members of the committee or any other legislator who hears that as a problem. Our goal in all of those is to work cooperatively with the utilities because, frankly, that's the only way it really works. There is some, as I say, though, there is some natural tension. In fact, one of the things we were talking about is if you're responsible for the maintenance side and you've got a general manager over you, one of the things you can do is invite in the regulator and say, don't you think we ought to fix this? And the way that message gets transferred to the general manager is, well, the state's requiring us to do this. So there is a little bit of natural tension there, but that's not our goal. I mean, that doesn't work. We pride ourselves in having good relationships with the utilities, and you know, too, we do expect that they will live up to the codes. They're not codes that we develop. They are, frankly, industry codes, and within reason, and they'll live up to those codes because that's the safety issue. And don't get really hard-nosed unless it's, we believe it's, our staff believes it's a threat to life. They do have an outlet in terms of the working with that. If a utility thinks that our staff is not, is being overly hard-handed, they can appeal to the commission. That has happened in some past, those cases in the past, not since I've been on the commission. And that is a legitimate outlet, and the commission will take a look at that. So.
Senator Morris.
Enter into any inspections where there's an overlap with your staff and
we don't do OSHA work. They could come in. The OSHA's perspective is more on worker safety. Ours is on safety in general. You know, our concern would be the wire spacing, so that it's unlikely that an unqualified person would be. And I'm thinking in this case, like pole attachments, you're not going to have a cable installer who isn't really trained to deal with power, is in the middle of a transformer or something like that. Or picture that I was looking at yesterday, I think is good, is the power drop coming to the house needs to be a certain number of feet away from a window or a door opening. It doesn't sound like a big deal, but if you think about it, if there's one, they were showing me a picture where one was just right outside and below a window. A young child, without thinking, could just reach out and grab it. So ours is that kind of a thing to trying to deal with the safety on that. OSHA, I think, is much more, their issue is not the general public. Their issue is worker safety. So, to some extent, I suppose there could be, but we're not thinking that way. Alrighty, move on. The third issue that we talked about is the impact of potential sale of PG and what that would mean. And I have to preface this and say that we have not intentionally given this a great amount of thought because there's so much that's up in the air, and we just haven't. We did go back and sit down and work out four possible scenarios that could come off of that and what the likely impact would be. And again, I want to say that if there was a sale to a public entity, we would be back working with DAS and working with the legislature because it would have a substantial impact with us. It represents approximately, I'm trying to find the percentage in there. It's just a little under, isn't it? 30% of our revenue base is PGE's, the fees from PGE. So it does have an impact. If it were totally sold to a public entity, totally owned by a public body, we would not have a direct relationship in regulating the general quality or the rate making of that entity. And so they would not pay us a fee directly. We would continue to have the safety responsibilities that are true across the board, and I think you can see with that obviously that's going to change the way we have to do business because we lose some economies of scale when we do that. The second potential would be where you had a public entity taking over part of it and the rest would remain independent. In that scenario, we would have an upfront responsibility to make sure that the ratepayers that remained with the private utility were protected, and then ongoing responsibility with that. But we would have much more of a detailed discussion about what was paid and how much the assets stayed with the ratepayers of the private entity. And that would be an odd one. That's a confusing one because you're talking about not just the wires and poles that deliver the powers, but the harder discussion is the generating assets that are owned and who gets those. That's always been a sticky issue and that kind of thing. The third scenario is PGE is sold to another private entity. That would be the classic role for the PUC in terms of we would be deeply involved in the structure of that sale and approving that. Approving it from the context of maintaining their financing structure so that the utility remains sound and setting the rates, making sure that the rates didn't increase as a result of that. One of the confusions, I think Commissioner Hemingway has written a piece recently that deals with that. People get confused over what happens in that sale. We look at, from a rate-making perspective, and this is traditional across the United States in rate-making, we don't look at what the company or what somebody pays for the company. We look at the book value of the company. If somebody overpays for it, that's the purchaser's problem. They don't get more rates out of that. We're looking at a depreciating value in rate making and the debt that goes along with that, and it's the fair establishment of that. Commissioner Hemingway will deal with that a little bit more when we get into rate making. But I think that's a confusion, and I think that's one of the key issues as you talk about a potentially public takeover. Sort of the assumption in a public takeover is that you'd 100% debt financing. In a private purchase, we would never authorize that. So there's a difference in how much you're financing and how that gets into rates. In a public financing, again, because it's different, is all of the money would flow into rates because that's the only source of revenue that they have to repay that debt with.
Lee, let me ask you a question about that. You know, 65%, if Multnomah bought it, 65% are outside of Multnomah County. If they decided we're going to take all of the hydropower that is owned by the, and that's ours, and the rest of you are going to pay off the market, there would be nothing to stop us. Nobody could come in and say that's really unfair practice if, in fact, under that scenario, they owned it.
Senator, I think the answer to that is we wouldn't approve that sale.
But if it's totally public, would you have any? In other words, you wouldn't approve the sale under those circumstances.
On the private side, yeah.
You're talking about a situation in which the private company would still be a private company.
No, I'm saying they just buy it outright and they manage.
Oh, totally public purchase.
Yeah.
And they allocate thermal costs to high cost power outside of Multnomah County.
65%.
Yeah. The only thing that I think stops them from doing that is regulations of the Bonneville Power Administration, which prevent discrimination in rates. But you have raised a very significant issue around this Portland City takeover of PGE, because PGE does serve in 8 counties. And the city is aware of this, but yet hasn't gotten to the threshold, I think, of starting to talk about what they would do about it. But clearly there is a governance question of PGE if it ends up serving if the city ends up owning a company that serves in 8 counties. And that's certainly a legitimate discussion for the legislature with the city of Portland. Well, if the city buys it, we are out of the discussion.
That's what I'm worried about. Yeah.
And there's a significant mix of people.
That's right.
There's a significant mix of resources there that's not easy to understand. PGE owns some of its own dams. The biggest one is the Pelton Dam out in Central Oregon, which by itself raises a question that has been raised, I know, by the counties where that is saying, how about the property taxes? You know, PGE pays property taxes to the county now. Does anybody pay property taxes if the city of Portland owns it? That's a question. They also own a coal-fired plant. It's a joint agreement in Boardman.
Mm-hmm. Boardman, yeah.
That's an issue. They also own a portion of a coal-fired plant in Montana called Colstrip. They also have some long-standing power contracts with some public utilities, hydro contracts in the state of Washington that has some conditions on it of if there's ownership change, they may not pass to the new owner. And then they have Bonneville. Mm-hmm. Their rights there, which are restricted in terms of how you deal with that and what you can do with those contracts. So it's not, I'm sensing I'm coming across negative here, and I don't mean to do that. I just want to imply that it's not as simple of a process as has been suggested in the media. You know, when you reduce everything to a 15-second sound bite, it makes it sound a whole lot easier than it is. And particularly when you start slicing that, it's very different. I adequately covered that. If we've adequately confused you all now.
Well, you have all these variables that are dependent on each other because they're going to have an effect. So you can't really give an exact answer. I don't think that's possible.
Well, you've caught what I was trying to say.
But to me, the issue is, and that's why I keep thinking, boy, it looks like there may be a need for legislation. It looks like this is going to happen. Is the reason you guys are there is basically to protect the public from unfair practices. Here would be a case where, man, the potential for unfair practices would be enormous, but yet you would have no scrutiny over that if in fact it was done in a certain way.
Mr. Chair, you've hit exactly at the way the Commission views its role. We are there as the representatives for the ratepayers. We are their watchdog to make sure that they're getting a reasonable deal. That's why we don't protect the utilities. That's not our job. Our job is to protect the ratepayers in a fairly legal process that's fairly complicated.
Senator Morris.
Sir, if you were to receive a request from the legislature to do an analysis, among other things, analyze the risk to the ratepayer and analyze the tax effect of investor-owned utility, how long would that take you?
Mr. Chairman, you want to take it?
If the legislature asks us to walk through a minefield, we'll do it, of course. My name is Roy Hemingway. I'm the chair of the commission, for the record. I imagine we could do that in about 60 days. The staff is probably watching on TV and going, oh no, because I'm always promising that they'll do something faster than they think they're able to, but this shouldn't be that complicated to at least lay out all the variables. I don't think we're going to be able to say, you know, yes or no, this is a good idea or a bad idea, but we certainly can lay out the variables and the risks and the range of benefits and risks.
All right. I would judge that or conclude, since you folks have not been engaged in any of these discussions, that this as a public policy issue has not surfaced yet within this body, and maybe it should with respect to these issues, the risks, and whether that in fact is, if Portland was to purchase it, is that in the best public policy interest? I think that's a legitimate question. So I would suspect that there are ways that we need to be discussing as to whether that's an interest we want to pursue within our body.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, the one thing I would caution you is that I think that it's we can provide you information and lay out the data and the facts and so forth, but it would be, I think, inappropriate for us to suggest what the public policy answer to that question should be. That's really yours and the citizens of Portland and the counties that are within that territory. We've been, as I'm sure you can tell, sort of walking gingerly around this because we're not wanting to stick our nose in where it isn't wanted. And the other side of that, and frankly, it's been an issue for us, is trying to fulfill our responsibility to make sure that the ratepayers that we represent have the information and sort of they're putting their other hat on the citizens to make an informed decision. And sometimes when we offer the information or comment on that, we sort of get our hands slapped a little bit, but that's what you pay us for.
Senator Dukes.
My sense is that the chair and others are concerned about what happens if a city government takes it over and is suddenly producing or selling to folks who don't have any recourse to that city government, the other seven counties and the folks outside. But when we were talking about the Burnside Water Association, didn't you say that you may have some responsibility if they were selling to people outside their area? And so I'm wondering, wouldn't, for example, the people of Yamhill County, if they're receiving PGE electricity and suddenly it's owned by the city of Portland, wouldn't they fall into that same area? I mean, unless the city were to set up a board that had a representative from Yamhill County on it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ducey, I think the answer to that is, while it's somewhat gray around associations, as I articulated a little while ago, it seems to be clear around public entities. The law specifically allows the citizens, through their government, to make that kind of an acquisition. So that, and I don't think the statute, I don't think the statutes have envisioned you would have them serving outside. But there are examples of that, and I'll give you one that I'm familiar with.
Wouldn't the public have recourse?
No, not under existing law.
Okay, even though they have no recourse to the governing body that may be making those decisions, they still wouldn't have recourse to you?
That's correct.
Oh, okay. I know, I see why you're concerned.
65%.
My folks got, my part of my district got out of it. They went PUD and annexed PGE's area into the PUD. So.
Well, at the risk of beating a dead horse, we sort of did that, and I'd like to move on.
Moving right along.
The third one. Which is actually the fourth one, I'm sorry. You asked us, Senator Morse asked us to go into a little bit more detail, and I think it was about how do we do rate making, and specifically I think some questions about how we did the rate making in the PGE's last rate case, which was actually settled before I was on the commission. From our knowledge, it's called case 2 weeks. 2 weeks. Actually, most of it was done beforehand. We thought it would be helpful to kind of give you a little bit of how the PGE case went along and show you what a rate order actually looks like, hand that out, and where we're at in rates now. And then Commissioner Hemingway was going to actually take you through how we do a rate case, if that works. The first piece I wanted to share with you is, so that you get a sense of this, is I'm going to step away from this.
I speak loudly, but we'll pick it up. If you actually look at PGE's...
Why don't you guys turn the mics? Can you hear a little bit?
I'm sorry.
I think you have this in the package too, but it's I don't believe it's in color. We don't do things in color now. These were done before. The difference is here is for comparison purposes, I've got two charts. One is going to show you it on the actual cost, the dollar volume, and the other one is the per kilowatt. In fact, I think I have the wrong one up first.
Have to hold it?
Okay. She said she's all right.
We're okay. This piece looks at the actual cost of the energy. 1996 was the last time PGE had a rate case before they came in for the one that we approved in 2001. And if you look across the bottom, this is the actual elements of a rate case, or particularly this rate case. The first one is their cost of power. And that includes both the contract, the power they were buying outside, as well as the power that they were producing. The next one is their fixed cost, O&M, depreciation on their assets, taxes, the two categories of taxes, and then the actual expected return on investment. Keep in mind when we do a rate case, what we're using is a test year, and we're predicting what their costs and expenses are going to be to set up a rate that assumes they can get this. Now, under that, they may get this kind of return or they may not. In fact, in the case of PGE, the rate of return that was authorizing their rate, they're making far less than that because of the economy and that. So we're dealing with what's there. As you can see, the changes on this, in most cases, if you look at all of this, fixed cost actually went down from what they had in their rates before. What went up is the cost of power. That's what drove the increase. That's what they actually were paying for, and that's what drove the increase. That's on an overall cost basis. If you look at it on a kilowatt, this is the way you see it on your home bill, is how many cents per kilowatt are you paying? You can see that it went up 173% of the cost increase you've seen in your bill. 173% of that resulted from the purchase of the power itself. And largely in PGE's case, and as I said yesterday, the difference, if you compare that to the other large private utility interstate, which is Pacific, Pacific generates most of its power. You didn't see this. You see some of it, but not the same. PGE was predominantly buying their power on the market out of their control, and that's where the increase came from. So that gives you a sense of, I think, of how that worked there. The other pieces that are in that packet that I wanted to give you is a glimpse of where were the rates at in other utilities at that period of time. And I'm referring to the page. It looks like this. It gives you perspective on where Oregon is now and how it fits in with the other states. There's a perception, there's always a perception that when your rates go up, that you're paying, you know, just incredibly more for energy than everybody else is. Well, you may be paying a lot more, but as this indicates, Oregon's rates are, as we said yesterday, are relatively in the marketplace. And I think these are fairly self-descriptive, so I'm not going to waste a lot of time. I did have one extra piece that was put in that looks like this, which is a comparison I thought would be helpful to you of Northwest utilities at the time PGE was doing this rate increase. What were others doing? And as you'll see, the other large utilities in the state were experiencing much the same thing, and both publics and privates. In fact, some of the public utilities had greater rate increases, but I want to be clear, having a greater rate increase doesn't necessarily mean that their ending cost went up higher. But they were all experiencing the same thing, and frankly, that was the effect of what was happening in the market in the years 2000 and 2001. So that's kind of a general context of how we did, where PGE was at, and where we're at today overall. Those rates are falling a little bit. Our biggest risk today in energy, frankly, is what happens with BPA and their debt situation, which is not in good shape. And the second piece of that is what happens with the snowpack, and it's both the water in-state, but more importantly, it's what happens with the snowpack up in Canada and in eastern Washington, because that's where, you know, that's the battery for the hydro system. The Columbia hydro system is what happens up there. If you don't have questions on this, I'll turn it over to Commissioner Hemingway, who's going to walk you through a little bit of a rate case to give you a sense of how we do this. And I did. I just want to tell you, this is it's voluminous, and I sort of debated whether to give this to you or not. But I think it's helpful, and just at your leisure, take a look at it. You get a sense of what we go through on the rate case. This is the actual order for PGE 115. It has all the analysis and the schedules and all that in it.
When you're analyzing the utility's costs, do you go in and do any spot audits to essentially certify in your mind that these costs are in fact what they're represented to be?
We did more of that in the past, but we still do it today. Generally, we have found that the major companies that we regulate are quite good about accounting for their costs in the appropriate manner. The staff has found some posting problems around some sales that PGE made with Enron, and maybe we can talk about that later, but generally we have found that their accounting practices are appropriate. And of course they do have to have an independent audit periodically, as any large corporation does.
Boy, before we go ahead, let me ask a question about this. Knowing people that...
Yes.
Go ahead.
Lee just wanted to point out that we do monitor their filings with the SEC, and our analysts spend a great deal of time poring over that kind of information.
Talking to the old-timers that used to maintain the system, they would tell you that, well, at a certain location here and a certain location over there, we had extra transformers, all the stuff ready to go, And today, you know, it's been limited down to such an extent that we have to wait sometimes for something to be brought in. Well, if we're looking at 911 scenarios, we're looking at, you know, the bad weather conditions, do we put pressure on them to keep those costs down, or do we allow them to manage that level of equipment and supplies in order to meet what they believe would be the emergencies?
Mr. Chairman, once we set rates, it's basically up to them as to how they manage to manage their costs. We do, however, have set service standards that we review annually with the utility, and a couple of those service measures are directly related to how quickly they respond to outages. The service standards cover, for instance, how many hours of outage the average customer experiences. We also cover how many, which is very important now for computer equipment, how many momentaries, these flickerings, these things that send your computer into orbit, are experienced by the average customer. Overall, we have seen a declining trend of both of the major utilities, Pacific Corp and PGE, that we regulate, and that their reliability is quite high. So they may be managing their inventory practices a little differently than they did in the past, but they're able to keep service up. 9/11 did raise some interesting questions, so far, we've had some discussions with them, but there will be increasing discussions about infrastructure as the Homeland Security Department gets geared up. And we do anticipate that we will start to see some attention placed upon where is the system the most vulnerable and where does it need to be armored, things like that.
That's something that really worries me. I drive by one major unit every day on the way in, and I think, oh, well, would this be an easy target? And that's just the way I think, and I'm sorry about that.
I would comment to you, Mr. Chair, that, in fact, I was speaking with the CEO of Pacific the other day, and one of the issues they raised is that they're taking another look at that, and I think a little generally about the cost that may be associated with that. And there's a... What did Chairman Greenspan said in the past of the increase in values of stocks or the irrational exuberance? I think we may be seeing a form of that around some of our security members. So we kind of have to balance that a little bit. I don't see a great desire by customers to see their rates go up a lot for that, but I think it's reasonable. It's a reasonable concern. We need to spend some time on.
For example, the one that I go by, that I drive by, I'm sure that if you came in and, for example, you know, it would use concrete blocks or poured something around it in order to protect it, that you'd probably then have problems with overheating because a lot of the things that's happening right there is some dissipation, you know, as in that transformer station. And so, you know, I'm sure that it's a very complex issue. And then you go back to what is the actual risk. We're ready.
I want to briefly, and this is Roy Hemingway again, the chair of the commission, to walk you through how a rate case is conducted, because that's the major activity of the commission and certainly where the public sees the results of our work the most dramatically. I want to emphasize from the start that rates that we set are prospective. We don't look at costs that occurred in the past. We look at what we expect costs to be in the future. And so if PGE just had a bad year because of snowpack or something, that won't necessarily influence our discussions about rates in the future. And for instance, if PGE didn't pay taxes last year, we may set rates based upon our expectation of how much taxes they will pay. And if it turns out that they end up not paying any taxes, we don't change the rates immediately to deal with that. We set the rates, and it's up to them to manage their costs within the rate structure. Rates are set in a formal process. There's a lot of money on the table here. The last PGE rate case raised rates by about $400 million. So we want to make sure, and the state has always wanted to make sure that the company has proved its case, and so we go through a very formal process under statute that's very similarly to those conducted in other states. And the burden of proof on who must prove something to go forward is on the utility. They must prove under law that they need the rates that that they're proposing. And if they don't meet that burden of proof, it doesn't matter who else was in the case, who else participated and said what, we simply won't approve the increase. A very critical role in our cases is played by the administrative law judge. We call them the ALJs. And the administrative law judge is the one who manages the case for us during the time that it is ongoing. Sets the meeting, sets the schedule for the when testimony is due, when rebuttal testimony is due, when cross-examination will take place. Typically, a case starts with the utility making a filing, which is a bundle of papers, which we're trying to get now to be an electronic filing, which lays out their request and informal court-like testimony written down from their experts explains why they think they need this. Then we assign an administrative law judge to that case. The administrative law judge starts to set a schedule for other parties to file requests for intervention and schedule for filing of other testimony and rebuttal testimony, etc. The staff of the commission is always a formal party to any rate case. Other parties may come in as interveners. And generally we have a pretty liberal intervention policy, that is anybody may join, but they do have to be represented by a lawyer because this is a complicated process. We have a, this is a critical question for the commission over the years, is we necessarily must run this as a formal process, but the formal process without question keeps a lot of people out and unrepresented who have a big stake in the outcome of and will be affected by our decisions. So a great deal of burden is on the staff to represent the public interest, and a great deal of burden is put upon our consistent interveners in our cases, the Citizens Utility Board and the Industrial Customers of Northwest Utilities that represents industrial customers in our proceedings. We hope to put before the legislature this session a request for what's called intervener funding to help with those who intervene in our rate cases and represent customers. We'll have a lot more opportunity to talk about that later if that legislation comes before the legislature and may well come before this committee and subcommittee. But we are trying to deal with the fact that we do have a formal process that is not terribly accessible to the public by its very necessity. We do in major cases go out and hold public hearings to listen to the public, but generally the major record that is built upon the formal testimony and the by the expert witnesses. A typical major rate case may take 9 months, and that is with the filing of the testimony, the setting of hearings, the setting for rebuttal testimony, the setting of cross-examination, and we have added one more step in that in the last, since I came on, and which is that from almost all of these cases now, we have an oral argument in front of the commission, where in a somewhat more informal style than in the standard cross-examination usual way it's done in commission cases, the commission can interact with the major parties in the case, ask them questions, and the major parties can present things directly to the commission rather than in this formal process with the ALJ presiding. Once a record is finished in a case, and that record may be thousands of pages long, the commission then will start its process for making its decision. We will often have met with the ALJ throughout the proceedings in order to help direct the proceeding as it goes forward, whether what the schedule should be, what major issues should be developed and discussed in the proceeding. But as we reach towards the end of the proceeding, the ALJ will start to talk with us and start to prepare a draft order. in formal proceedings like this, this is the one circumstance under law where we are able to meet outside of the public eye without the public being present. Otherwise, Lee and I cannot talk about any subject in front of the commission. But in a situation like a rate case where we are sitting at, in a quasi-judicial process under law, we do meet outside the public eye and discuss the rate cases in what we call a decision meeting. We will then, as this draft order starts to be refined, it starts to turn into what you have in front of you, which is that major piece of work that often will be a 40 to, I think our longest order so far has been like 75 pages long, where we go through each of the issues raised in the case by the parties and decide the issue, and then we eventually get to the bottom line and make decisions. The substance of the case is decided, and I can show you in this chart that looks like this. And the first thing we do is establish the overall revenues that the utility must be able to earn, which is called the revenue requirement. We then determine how that revenue requirement should be spread among the various customer classes, industrial customers, commercial customers, large commercial, small commercial, and residential customers. And then within each class, there's a thing called rate design, which is how do you how much is paid in for residential customers in the first 500 kilowatt hours, and how much for the next 500 kilowatt hours, or how much in the flat fee charge. And there's a great deal of argument and theoretical discussion about those particular items. Finally, we end up then with something that is a rate order that can tell the utility how much they are allowed to raise rates or how much they may be ordered to reduce rates to their customers. I'm not going to go into how we set rate of return and rate base unless you have specific questions about that. There is one more paper in front of you which looks like this. It says Northwest Natural UG 152 General Rate Case. And this is just one case that's in front of us right now, which is Northwest Natural filed a couple of months ago for an overall general rate case, I think a rate increase of, what, about 7%, somewhere, yeah, 6-point-something percent. And this is just the staff assignment of areas in that particular case. And you can see that they're covering the entire operations of that company, and the company is trying to prove that these are the legitimate costs, and the staff of the commission will then look into those costs very carefully and determine whether they think those costs are legitimately laid out and where they deserve, where those increased costs, if the company is claiming that, are legitimate. I want to emphasize again that the staff is a formal party. And as such, staff members who are working on a rate case do not talk with commissioners during the pendency of the case about the case. So we may see each other in the lunchroom or the bathroom or in a food drive event or something, but we aren't talking about, well, I don't ask a staff member, well, how's your testimony on the Northwest Natural case going, and they don't tell me about it, because they must participate in the formal process, and that creates an atmosphere of fairness for all the participants in the process. That basically concludes my running through how a rate case is conducted. I think I would want to leave you with the impression that the commission takes its work very seriously, that the work is very technical. We do try to make this process as much as possible open to the public. There are certain limitations by law and by the nature of the material that make it difficult to keep it accessible to the public, but we try to do our best.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Rick Willis with staff. The next three questions, I believe, we touched on earlier. There were questions from Senator Morse, and started with questions about a chart that flowed into cost per FTE and why was our cost, at least on the surface, appeared high. And earlier we discussed that I would meet with Cindy and Satish when we work up some figures specific to PUC that would be compared to other state agencies. So if that's sufficient, I'll move on to the next question.
Okay. That sounds good.
The next question came from you, Mr. Chair, which was about cost containment related to the IS project that we're working on, the e-filing, and you had asked about cost of the e-filing. And we have a handout for you that breaks it down. Cost to date is about $279,000. And the breakdown for that is we've spent about $40,000 for professional services. And that is we hired a consultant who's an expert in this field that assisted our staff in planning for the project, giving us some recommendations on the software to buy, helped with preparing the documentation, and generally helping our staff to build the system. Our staff is building the system. This person is kind of hanging over the shoulder, watching them. What we wanted was in-house expertise. We needed to hire a consultant to help gain that. So that's professional services part. We have about $41,000 in hardware and software purchases. And that's to buy things like a document conversion tool. And that is where different companies have different kinds of software, WordPerfect, Word. And if you've ever worked with some of those, if you don't have a conversion document, you've got a mess on your hands when you try to merge those all together. So it's to buy the kind of software that helps to convert different types of documents into something that we can use and then ultimately put on our website. The major portion is in-house costs, and that is for staff work. And we've estimated that that is about $198,000 worth of inside staff work to work on this project, the planning, the all the purchases, the documentation, those sorts of things. So for a total of $279,000 to date for that project.
Mr. Chair,
introduce.
I'd like to commend you. You are the very first agency I've ever seen come forward with a technology package that makes sense. And it wasn't through the roof.
Yeah.
I mean, we pay $10,000 for a website. Hundreds of thousands of dollars for a simple database. If we go back mm-hmm. to aviation, they were yeah. one little piece of this simple database, and their piece was $100,000. So I commend you.
Thank you, Senator. And let me say that we at the PUC are extremely fortunate. We have an outstanding IS group. So we're very fortunate to have that group, and they can do these kinds of things.
Didn't happen accidentally.
Well, and also for it to include not only the hardware, but the software.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we will. Next one, Lee, I think is yours.
Oh,
number nine. To talk about cost.
There was a question. I think the question was for
Mr. Chair, I think your question related to Senate Bill 622 and 99 and mm-hmm. the conversion of Quest into the rate cap. And if you're not dealing with the rate design on Quest anymore, doesn't that reduce the paperwork? If only it were so. Keep in mind, again, when I mentioned the other day that Quest is one of 400 mm-hmm. telephone yeah. companies in the state yeah. that we're doing business with. They are by far the largest company. But their rates are capped on their local service, but there are many other things, and included in trying to deal with keeping a competitive environment, we deal with their service agreements that are available to others to buy things under wholesale costs, the complaint levels that I discussed the other day. So the as I said yesterday, deregulation isn't easier or cheaper. It actually
it's not deregulation, it's intensification of regulation. It's just a cap on the prices. The deal, there are two principal benefits, I think, to the public on Senate Bill 622. One was the investment that the public got in putting together service rings, fiber rings throughout the state, five rings. When that's done, that it is an immense benefit to every telephone company in the state and every citizen to have that there. The second one is there, the basic costs are capped on that, but there are a lot of other costs that we freed up under that, you know, whether you want to have voicemail or caller ID and those kinds of things, and making sure that that system works hasn't, at least in our opinion, made life simpler for the regulators. The other issue, I'll just tell you, there's a case in front of the FCC. It's been in front of them for a while. The papers this morning indicated they're going to rule on that. It has to do with the pricing at the wholesale level of some of the telephone services. And depending, in fact, I guess it probably doesn't make much difference. It makes a lot of difference what they decide, but once they make the decision, it's going to cause a ripple effect through every state and every regulatory environment and how we deal with that. So competition isn't easier. Hopefully the end result is better for the customers.
I feel your pain, Sister Idea. We both were doing,
you're both doing the dental routine, yeah.
Little root canals.
Ouch.
The every month I'm driven crazy by the fact that on my telephone bill are things I don't know a darn thing about. And MSNBC has ended up on every telephone bill I had. And I'm always trying to argue with the telephone company. I have computers, but they're each at my state capital office or my district office. I don't have one at home. Yet I'm winding up with all this stuff on my telephone bill sometimes, and nobody want to take responsibility for it. It drives me wild. So what does the average person do?
They get a consumer complaint form.
Mr. Senator, do you have a DSL line?
I don't. I'm going to be getting
That's the ISP, default ISP for...
We may have a slamming issue.
You may have a slam.
Somebody
did.
So I did work out with some slams from some of the state. I worked that out, and they finally took that off. But then they refer you to all these other little... What got my attention when you said there are over 400 telecommunications companies in the state. So it would be hard to keep up with it, but who takes final responsibility for all this stuff that's just ending up on your telephone? I have so many elderly people calling me on this stuff, mm-hmm. too.
No, the answer is it depends, and maybe no one. The slamming and cramming we discussed yesterday is an issue that is currently the legislature has not given the PUC authority to deal with that. It has been dealt with on a general basis by the Department of Justice as part of their Uniform Trade Practices Act to try to get consent orders, but they do not deal with individual customers. It's one of the things that we've suggested to the legislature. We have four bills in to deal with that to give us the authority to meet with it. We try to provide guidance to citizens who call us, but the basic guidance, if they've been slammed, is call the FCC, which and at the risk of sounding odd, isn't much help. They sort of, you'll get their call center and they'll refer you back to the PUC or to the Department of Justice. It's not a good issue. But with respect to your bill, if you would like to share your bill with us, we'll try and tell you what you're being charged for.
Okay.
It's not an unusual call that our customer service people get, people trying to understand their bill. On our web page, we've tried to put, and I actually think it's pretty good, an explanation for the consumer of how to read your telephone bill. But it's not the easiest thing. There's a lot of special costs that are on there. And people get confused. And although many people, I will tell you, notice that when it goes up 1 cent for universal service or something like that, we get lots of calls.
Representative Krieger.
Getting back to that same subject, I'm willing to bet you there's not a person in this room that can read your monthly phone bill. I mean, you just can't. I just saw the thing. Go take it and try to figure out which calls you can deduct as a business call. And here's one to the Bahamas. I never called the Bahamas, but yet they got it from my phone. I mean, how do you fight that? And it's every phone bill you get, you're going to have two or three items on there that do not relate to you. I might have been in New York when that call was made from my phone. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously these bills are being loaded by somebody. It is accidental.
And Mr. Chair, Representative, in fairness, usually if you'll call the long-distance carrier on that, they'll usually take it off your bill. But I think to the extent that someone's playing with your bill, they're assuming most people are going to just throw up their hands and write a check. I don't want to suggest that's a real problem because we have a pretty good relationship, particularly with the large carriers.
I'm hoping that this slamming and cramming, whatever else you call it, that we do something with them and give them some authority because it's long overdue. We're all putting up with it.
Well, it's in the House committee. If you'd want to share that with your chair.
if I could, Mr. Chair, if I could add one thing to answer Representative Krieger. We do publish a pamphlet called How to Understand Your Telephone Bill because it has gotten quite complicated, and I believe that information is also on our website.
We'll bring those with you for us.
We'll be happy to. But we also, as one of our objectives for the future, which we're starting to work on, we've asked our staff to start to work on, is a consumer education effort for people to understand, help them understand their choices with respect to telephone service, telecommunication service, because we do find a lot of elderly and less informed people are signing up for services or finding services on their bill that they didn't think they wanted or deserved or wanted to sign up for. One of the things about the capitalist system and the competitive environment is that there's all sorts of opportunities to sell things to people who don't necessarily need them or want them. And with deregulation moving in telephone, we see our role moving more or less from a judge role into more of a referee role and more of a consumer education role so that we can help people understand their choices and understand when they are being defrauded and how they can take action.
I'm just going to jump up on the pile. Senator Carter, I have to tell you, I enjoy working with you so much. You raise issues that really hit home with a lot of people. I got my phone bill, decided I'd had it enough, decided to invest 3 hours of my life into trying to decipher my phone bill. Called up my company, both the long distance and local, went line item by line item by line item, came out of there more confused than I started. And I know I'm not that smart, but I, with my finance background, I know how to at least somewhat trip through something. I couldn't understand it. And so I would hope that, you know, we'd continue to work on that sensitivity. You're right on that.
So. It's slamming, cramming, confusion.
Yeah, exactly.
Mr. Chair.
Well, Mr. Chair, well, Senator Carter, I'll tell you, you're not alone. The gentleman two chairs over from me actually had a little problem with DSL that he took him forever, finally gave up on, and you would think the chairman of the PUC could get something worked out.
Some
respect.
It took me an hour to get my DSL service canceled with Quest. I called up to say I no longer want service, and they kept putting me into a menu because I think the individual people on the line, they get something deducted from their commissions if they have a service which is canceled. And so they didn't want to be the one who handled my call, I think, was what was going on. And it literally took an hour.
And a couple of your colleagues have also called me in the last couple of months about services that they bought, didn't realize, and wanted to change and got a $600 bill for cancellation of contract. And then it's what contract? And we kind of walked through that. It's legitimate. It's all there. It's just someone calls you on the phone and says, wouldn't this be a better deal for you? Don't you think I can help you? And this is fairly common for small business. And they says, that sounds like a good deal. Well, let me just fax you an agreement, and you fax it back, and we'll have that change in place soon. Well, there's a lot of the proverbial small type on there. And all of a sudden, they discover that the service is not as good as they thought it was going to be, and they want to switch back to who they had before or to somebody else and realize that they've got this prepayment penalty contract there, and they didn't realize they did it. So I think that's just the nature of that's sort of one of the downsides of having a competitive market. But by and large, you know, the phone service is very good. The large companies we're working with continue to do generally a pretty good job. The sort of the one that you've seen in the papers before has been Quest, and their service is much better. But there's, I believe strongly that there's a need for the team with the black and white shirts to make sure that there's someone there to help you out. And the continuing role, as Commissioner Hemingway said, that we're trying to figure out is as we move into this new competitive environment, how do we do a better job of representing ratepayers and help them be better consumers? And it's a challenge, and I'll tell you that it is an issue in all 50 states as we're trying to figure out how to do that one. But
it's they call it thuggish behavior. In business, they call it complications. I beg the difference.
Oh, I was just going to compliment Representative Smith. You only have one long-distance carrier? 2 years ago when we were here, I had discovered that I didn't have any.
Oh my God.
They had just abandoned me once while I was using a long-distance card and a phone card, and I think that they discovered that they weren't getting any service. So with no notice, they just were gone. And then I noticed a while after that I had two. Not a clue where they came from.
With your permission, Mr. Chair, I'm going to back us right out of that question.
We can always talk about MCI. That took me the better part of a year.
I would tell you, if I were running these companies, I would flag names like Hemingway and Carter and Dukes. I would put little tags on there so don't mess with these people. Go ahead.
Some other state.
What number are we on?
I want to be on the list.
Okay, what are
the average consumers? It helps us a lot.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. There's a lot of old proverbs about that very thing.
Thank you, down to 10.
Mr. Chair, I'll cover 10 and 11, and there's similar questions. First one is asking if we have a method in place to track our fees collected for each department. And the answer is yes. It's a little more difficult today than it was 2 years ago because last session the Ways and Means Subcommittee did a little tweaking with our sections in the budget for each one. So it's a little more difficult, but yes, we can still track by each department. It goes on to ask, is the fee amount collected for energy utilities used to support that program only, or are energy utilities fees used to support other activities? And the answer is other activities. Mm-hmm. As we discussed yesterday, for example, the water program does not pay for itself, mm-hmm. and there is some slop over to help support that program.
The question, too, when you guys were talking about, okay, you're going to move a block, because a rate case is coming up, you're moving a block of folks over here to do this.
Right.
My assumption was that there would be hard not to have a carryover, a slop over, however you want to describe that, of keeping them separate. And so what you're saying is that that does occur.
That's correct. That does occur. So, and as our workload shifts, for example, right now, and I'll show you some numbers, that we may have a number of cases in the electricity area. It'll move that way. And so for a given period of time, electricity will look like it's getting subsidized by the other areas.
Right.
But in a year, 2 years, three, it may be telecommunications. Mm-hmm. And if you look at that picture in time, you'll say, oh, well, telecommunications is getting subsidized.
Right.
So you have that movement back and forth. We try to set it up that way deliberately so that we have the resources necessary to go to the area that needs the attention at the time. And it works very well, frankly. And we talked about that one section within the commission that serves the different sections when they have a rate case and need experts, economists, and those sorts of things.
Okay. If one of the folks paying the PUC fees had a concern, they could come to you, you could show them something like this and say, here's what happens. Basically, you need the flexibility.
That's right, Mr. Chair. In fact, we have talked to the utilities about this issue. They are aware that they are having subsidized water, and they don't particularly have a big problem with it. It's a pretty small amount. And again, they understand that we need to be able to have that flexibility to shift resources back and forth to address workload issues as they come up. Okay. Second part of the question is provide a tracking of the cost for each program to ensure that the players who fund PUC are not subsidizing one program with funds collected from another. And in fact, they are. And we've handed out to you a list that has electricity, natural gas, water, and telecommunications. And you see the top row up there has the revenues collected. The second row is the expenditures, and those are both the direct and indirect expenditures for each one of those sections. And then the bottom line is the balance below. And you can see that right now, electricity, for example, has revenues of about $11 million and expenditures of about $10 million. But if you go over to telecommunications, they have revenues of about $6 million and expenditures of about $9 million. Again, it's that shift back and forth that demonstrates.
If we had, you know, because as Lee described, you know, 400 participants and all of a sudden in a new area, if in fact you continue to have telecommunication, you know, pulling money out from electricity, natural gas, probably at some point you would go for a rate shift change or something like that. But what you're saying is overall, if you look at like 5 or 10 years, it balances out.
It's balanced out. That's right. We find that our workload just shifts back and forth. It's kind of like a wave. And at any given time, you'd say, what's the major issues in front of the PUC? It could be natural gas. It could be electricity. It just shifts back and forth.
Senator Carter?
Yeah, a little bit. But I would like for you to do assessment, maybe not assessment, do a corollary between the revenues of the water system versus the expenditures and kind of compare that to if in the possibility of all realms that the city of Portland or the county of Multnomah were to take over the PGE enterprise, is this more to come of this kind of thing? Is that a possibility?
Think about that.
Think about what you're saying there. Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, let me split the question. And yesterday we talked a little bit about the water, and that was the concern that came out of the last session was our electric, gas, and electric and telephone customers unduly subsidizing water. And the answer to that is, yes, they are subsidizing water. The cost of running the water program is about $400,000 a year. It's not a huge expense, but it's there. And the amount of fees that they generate is in the $40,000-$50,000. We had a committee that looked at all that, and the key that turned around on that is there's a rate structure that, you know, sets in statute the legislature has set that says how much we can charge, and their point is that, their point being the water committee that was composed of customers and utilities and others, was for the public regulation, they shouldn't have to pay more than other regulated utilities are paying our customers. That's kind of the logic along that. The issue and how that relates with PGE, I think what you're asking is if PGE becomes a public utility and no longer is paying fees, what will that do to the spread across among the PUC and the other programs? We dealt with that a little earlier in the meeting today before you got here, and the answer is, the real answer is, we don't know. They make up a little less than 30% of our revenues. Obviously, if that revenue base is not there any longer, that's a huge financial hit to our budget, and we'll have to make adjustments. How that operates and the responsibilities that the PUC will have for whatever the next iteration of PGE is depends on the structure itself. And that's a question that, you know, we're just not prepared to give an answer to because there's so many variables. Senator Morris asked that question in terms of if we laid out a lot of question marks, if you will, that you as a consumer, a ratepayer, PG, may want to ask the city or others, and the senator implied that he may want to ask the PUC to jump into that minefield. And I think the chairman said, well, if you ask us if we'll walk through the minefield, if you ask us, we probably will, but very gingerly. Did that get at your question?
My answer is just worrying me about the revenue return, you know. And I think this is one of the places where you ask, is it better in the hands of private enterprise or it's in other public entity? And I think when you look at the revenues, if we are subsidizing this much in the area of water, then it's like another subsidy is on its way when we have too many core services in the state that are suffering today, Mr. Chairman, and to take away a revenue stream of that nature in terms of the return on the revenue is something that it appeared to me that we can't be lackadaisical about it. So it must be a lot of study. And obviously, we're going to be looking to the PUC to give us some direction on this as a body. So, you know, politics aside, but the pros and cons of the wisdom that, for, you know, that is decided in terms of whether it's public or whether it's private. I mean, it's, it just can't continue to afford too many subsidies of this nature at the same time pay attention to the core value systems that all of us as Oregonians believe in strongly.
Mr. Chair, Senator, we were saying a little earlier, I think that if the legislature asks, the PUC can, we can call upon our expertise on staff that we have to, in essence, sort of flag and lay out some issues that the public and the legislature may want to consider, but it's not our role to say what's the appropriate decision.
Right, exactly.
Senator Carter, I don't know if you were here when we talked about that, but one of the issues is that if that...
Okay. You wish you were here.
The transaction occurred in Multnomah County. You know, that the purchase, 65% of the customers could not be in that jurisdiction. They would be in another jurisdiction. And the question was, is there would there be any PUC oversight on behalf of protecting the 65%? And so, you know, it's a question I think we all need to ask. And maybe, I mean, I know that everyone's going to really panic if I suggest maybe we need to do that. But all the staff is back there listening to us. But these are major, major questions. And I really get it. I become very uneasy when I see somebody who is not protected as far as some hope of fairness in any process. That really makes me nervous. We've all had our sermon for the day, so...
Mr. Chair, just one last piece that we talked about earlier, and that is understanding the phone bill. In the interest of customer service, we have for you pamphlets in English and Spanish.
All right.
How to understand your phone bill.
Mr. Chair, I got a publication from Water Resources on how to fill out an expedited permit for a three... Well, it was expedited permit, but it had six pages, but it took a seven-page booklet to explain it. I hope that isn't what I'm getting here. Am I getting a one-pager?
It's a one-page pamphlet.
Good.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Krieger, this is our test, then. You tell us whether it works or not.
We're in trouble. We can't get into it.
Mr. Chair, that's the end of the questions that you presented to us. We're available to answer any more now and in the future, and we appreciate this opportunity to discuss our program with you. We're biased. We think we've done a good job. At different times, our customers agree.
Well, you know, that brings up one question, and, you know, going back to the PG energy cost, and so much of that stuff, I wish during the time that we were facing the horrible heartburn of, you know, 50%+ rate increases, you know, for commercial power, that we would have had, you know, somebody tell us, well, you know, look what happened to their power costs. And of course, we all knew that. And but at the same time, you know, it certainly does. It comes back to the idea of, well, why did you do that when, in fact, it's so expensive? Well, it's because those people would have gone broke if you hadn't granted that.
Sometimes when you're mad, you really don't want to know why.
That's exactly right. I'm suffering. Any further questions?
Mr. Chair, I just think they've done a good job of some fairly complicated issues, and they recognize where the shortfalls are, and they've taken time, I know, to come by everybody's office, and I appreciate that.
Anything else to come before?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there will not be a meeting on Monday. It will be rescheduled.
Very good. Hey, now, I got you out of here early today, so you can go to place. Thank you guys very much for the presentation.
Another day, you can go back and see your dentist.
Oh, no thanks.
Is this root canal leaking?
Oh.
Oh, no, my hip can hurt.
You tell her to get in there.
What's that? We will be in there. I'm curious as to what was in your room.